is now in session. The Honorable Alexa D. Afrojuse, Catherine G. Leonard, and Brian M. Wade are presiding. Please be seated. Case number CAAP-16-0136, Floyd versus Brian Cole. Michael Zagami for appellant, Darlene Forsberg for appellant. Arguing on the merits.
Morning.
Good morning.
Let's start.
Good morning. I am Special Deputy Attorney General Mike Agami for the state. The state's position is straightforward. The state believes that the circuit court erred when it concluded that the statute of limitations began to run upon the discovery of the scheme when looking at Section 701-108-3A. The state believes that the circuit court erred because it disregarded, one, the plain reading and meaning of 701-108-3A, disregarded the design of it, and it can bring about absurd and unjust results. Now, looking at the plain meaning and reading of 701-108-3A, there is no mention of scheme.
Okay, but it does mention offense.
That is correct.
So, let's talk about offenses. What are the how many offenses have you charged?
Six.
Okay. And let's just talk about maybe one through five. What each of them is a continuing course offense, correct?
That is correct.
And
we've alleged different methods of theft. So each count is a different method of theft. That's how it was charged. Now, our position is that within each count are different theft offenses, and the state is allowed to aggregate these different theft offenses under 708-801 subsection 6. Where, and 708-801 subsection 6 reads that amounts involved in thefts committed pursuant to one scheme or course of conduct, whether property taken from one person or more than one, may be aggregated and determine the class or grade of the offense. So the state's reading is that you have multiple offenses, and then you look at, well, do each of these offenses meet SOL or within the SOL? And then if they are, then you can aggregate by scheme. And that's what the state did.
Okay, but let's talk about count three, for example.
Okay.
That's what I have it open to. It charges that on or between March 16, 2007 and July 6, 2010, in a continuing course of conduct, Laura Bertolo, you know, et cetera, by writing checks for herself.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so this is your what you've charged. Here, the offense, and correct me if I'm wrong, this is kind of the nut of it for me. The offense is that Ms. Bertolo wrote checks to herself between this date and that date in a continuing course of conduct. That's what the state chose to charge.
Yes.
Okay. But the state is saying that there were checks written in that period that they're just ignoring, correct?
That's correct.
And why, how is it that you get to pick and choose, you know, or to ignore things that are clearly part, if that is the continuing course of conduct, do you have some authority for ignoring some of them when, in order to extend the statute?
What we're doing is not ignoring them. We're following the mandates of 701-108-3, where you look to the offense committed. So each time she wrote a check, that was an offense. So you look at each offense and determine whether or not under 701-108-3A you fall within the statute of limitations. And those checks that did not fall within that were not part of the charge. Because if you look at 701-108-3A, it only talks about offenses. There's no phrase or words of scheme at all. And if you look at the design of 701-108-3A throughout the years, it's because you have these fraudulent transactions hidden within legitimate ones. So, you know, victims need time to sort through all of that to be able to, you know, determine which ones are fraudulent and which ones are not. And it goes to my point where if you follow what the court concluded, you get absurd and unjust results. And you can look at that just by looking at the report that Ms. Placencia made in August of 2010. She reported 8 checks between May of 2010 and July of 2010. Now, if you take the court's conclusion that the statute started to run in May of 2010, the other 7 checks weren't written yet, yet their statute of limitations had begun to run.
Okay, but now we're looking at this, or maybe I can ask it this way. Do you see a distinction between aggregating certain offenses and a course or conduct kind of charge?
Well, course of conduct is in the aggregation statute.
Sure, yeah. But it seems to me they might, because there's a use of different terms, that they may be trying to express different concepts. The idea that you can aggregate a number of independent acts or independent crimes, if
correct,
you will, might be different than the situation where you say, well, there is a continuing course of conduct and we can identify certain acts within that course. Both of them end up in the same place in the sense that you can aggregate the amounts. Mm-hmm. It's probably a bad word, but you can combine the amounts to get you to the 20,000 for the theft in the first degree. But they may not be the same concept.
I agree with you that there are certain situations where they're not the same, but I think when you look at in terms of statute limitations and the fraud exception, then you look at the aggregation statute and see the way we determine it is that does each offense meet the statute of limitations? And if so, can you aggregate to get a different grade of offense?
But if you charge it as a course of conduct,
yes,
then doesn't that imply a particular state of mind that there's a continuation and maybe the statute of limitations gets applied a little differently?
I'll be honest, I did not think of the possible distinction when I charged it. So I think I left off at the possibility of absurd and unjust results. So if you look at the 8 fraudulent transactions, one absurd result is that for 7 of the reported checks, the statute had begun to run before they were even written. That's absurd. That's unjust. Also, at the time of the report in August of 2010, you have 3 years of criminal conduct, fraudulent transactions that have been going on. You have hundreds of these transactions. I think it's unfair and unjust and absurd to say that because you found these 8 checks, now all of a sudden you discovered these hundreds of others in the 3 preceding years.
But say so you found the 8 checks, you're charging the 8 checks, you're already over the $20,000 amount that you need.
Correct.
For the theft first. Do you need any more? You're aware of those things, you're aware of those checks,
right,
and you have 3 years from that point to,
correct,
bring that charge. So I'm
that's
not,
correct.
Okay, so why is that absurd? You've already got offense that you can charge.
I'm not saying it's absurd that you're able to charge that. I'm saying it's absurd to say that all the unauthorized fraudulent transactions that occurred in the 3 preceding years, to say that their statutes begin to run, that's absurd and unjust.
Yeah, but I mean, I'm not sure I'm fully understanding the absurdity, because I think that's the purpose in some respects, like it or not, of a statute of limitations, right? Mm-hmm. It's, okay, you're on notice, you have 3 years to figure this out. I get that if you had charged individual offenses for later checks, or even, you know, started the clock with checks at a later period, but you didn't, you went backwards. And those acts also were part of that continuing course of conduct. You just plucked some of them out that had been, you know, reported.
That's correct. But it would be my position that it, if I charge it one way versus another way, in one way SOL would run and in another way SOL wouldn't run, to me that doesn't seem right. The basis of the way you charge determines whether or not statute of limitations has run or not.
Do you have any authority that supports that?
No. This is my common sense thinking. So the state's position is that in looking at 701-183A in conjunction with 708-8016, that the way we did it, you look at each individual offense, determine the statute of limitations, whether it had run or not, and if not, then aggregate by a scheme or course of conduct into the level of charge. And that's the correct way, and that's the way the state did it. The other thing that the state would like to bring up is that the court found that there was one scheme. General, I'm not sure why the court felt that way, but I take it that you have one victim, one intent to steal from a particular victim. I think that this way of thinking renders 708-806-8016 inoperable then, because if you read the language of 708-8016, it talks about thefts, different kinds of theft, and that you can charge it based on scheme or course of conduct. This would have no operation if you take it the way the court read it, that there's just one generalized scheme.
Does the scheme have any bearing on who the victim is?
No, I don't think so. Because I can think of a situation like, let's say, credit card fraud, where we just had a case, I think, in the papers where a waitress was taking the check, credit card slips, changing the tip amount, and then, you know, submitting that, so she was, and then pocketing the difference.
The critical feature is
different victims, but one scheme.
The critical feature is who the aggrieved party is, not necessarily a victim. Is there any distinction between aggrieved party and victim?
Mm. For purposes of this case, no, I don't think so.
So the state is the aggrieved party?
Well, we said either WCO, the recipient of the state funds, or the state who issued the state funds.
Is there anything in the record about whether WCO received funds from anyone else other than the state?
Not in the record, no.
So, assuming that we might have a problem with some of the offenses that, like checks that were written, or the offenses that include the checks that were reported in 2010. So what, if we reject the circuit court's conclusion that there was one scheme, what remains of the case? What is the relief you request? Assuming that.
I believe three counts would survive.
Because counts 4, 5, and 6 were not the ATM was not discovered until your investigation.
That's correct. The 4, 5, and 6 do not involve checks.
So you're saying clearly those are different schemes.
Correct.
So is it fair to say that the state charged 6 schemes in this case?
That's the state's position, yes.
To clarify, the ATM offenses are not included in WCO's civil case?
I don't have that with me. I'm not sure. I did not bring the complaint with me. If that's it, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Good morning. My name is Darcia Forrester. I'm a deputy public defender. I'll be representing Ms. Bitolo, the athlete, today. Excuse me, I have a little bit of a cold, so I might sound froggy.
So may it please the court. The trial court correctly granted the motion to dismiss the felony information with prejudice in this case. The trial court correctly held that the statute of limitations as codified in HRS 701-108 subsection 3A expired before the state of Hawaii chose to file a felony information charging Ms. Pitolo with theft offenses relating to her employment at the Waianae Community Outreach, which I will be calling the WCO from now on. The trial court was not clearly erroneous in its findings of fact, and the trial court was not wrong in concluding that the statute of limitations had expired. All offenses are alleged to have occurred during the course of Ms. Pitolo's employment with the WCO, which ended in 2010. The alleged thefts were discovered by the WCO on May 27, 2010, when the WCO began their investigation into financial irregularities specifically involving Ms. Pitolo. The WCO is the aggrieved party in this case, not the state of Hawaii. The discovery was made by the WCO through their executive director, Sofina Plasencia.
Counsel, excuse me, is it your contention there can only be one aggrieved party in a case?
Yes, it is our contention that the only aggrieved party in this case is the WCO, and that they are the ones who discovered the irregularities.
So, but just to understand, that's this case.
Correct.
Is it your contention that in any similar case there can only be one aggrieved party?
No, I think there can be more than one aggrieved party in other situations. But for this case, the aggrieved party, as envisioned in the statute of limitations, is the WCO. Discovery was made known to the state of Hawaii when a police report was filed with the Honolulu Police Department on August 7, 2010. The report was filed by the executive director of the WCO. The controlling statute is HRS 701-108, subsection 3A. It is our position that the WCO discovered a scheme to defraud the WCO of monies by Ms. Pitolo on May 27, 2010. So the scheme is the intent to defraud the WCO of monies.
But Ms. Forrester, we agree that the state has charged six offenses.
That is correct.
Not a single scheme.
Yes.
Okay, so isn't it the state's right to have multiple counts and charge different schemes? As far as dismissal with prejudice of a complaint, at this point in the case?
So our position is that the state is certainly has the ability and the right to choose to separate different methods, but the scheme is still one scheme, the scheme to defraud the WCO of monies. So we do not agree that there were six different schemes in this case. It's one scheme with different methods.
What is your authority for that?
Basically, we're relying on Stan's contracting. And so that is our authority for the discussion of how scheme comes into play and the use of the...
Right, but that there can only be one scheme.
So in this case, our position is that it was one scheme with multiple different types of transactions. In Stan's contracting, there were different methods used, but there was one scheme, or at least the court held that there was one scheme. So that's what we're relying on for this case, for the opinion that it's one scheme.
So it doesn't matter what methods by which someone furthers that scheme?
No, our position is that it's your intent that is controlling. So if Ms. Pitolo's intent is to defraud the WCO and she chooses four different methods or three different methods to execute that desire or that intent, then it's still one scheme. It's a continuing course of conduct, one scheme, different methods within the scheme.
Can you point to me where in Stan's contracting the court held that it was a single scheme?
Right. One moment. So I believe that would be on page 35, where they talk about that the statute of limitations begins to run when either the aggrieved party or the person who has a legal duty to represent the aggrieved party discovers the scheme. So it's not when an agent of the Department of the Attorney General discovers an offense or a method, but when the aggrieved party itself, in this case the WCO, learned of the scheme.
Right, but that doesn't mean there couldn't be more than one scheme that they find. I think that that is a critical argument with respect to some of these counts, and I'm not sure I read that to say a person can only commit one scheme against an aggrieved party. Because, for example, in this case, Ms. Pottola was alleged to have, the ATM scheme. Presumably, that was all for her, and she had the scheme with Dad. I think that I have a hard time reading Stan's contracting to address that.
So I guess the way I would answer your question is that part of the problem with Stan's contracting is they did not define scheme. So we don't have a definition of scheme. There is no definition of scheme in the HRS. In our briefs, both the state's brief and the appellate's brief and the appellee's brief, we use different definitions. So I believe in the state's brief, they relied on the Black's Law definition of scheme, which is a design or plan formed to accomplish some purpose, a system. When used in a bad sense, the term corresponds with a trick or a fraud. We relied on just a basic Webster's Dictionary definition of scheme, which would be a plan or program of action, especially a crafty or secret one. So we acknowledge that there's no HRS definition of scheme, but based on the common definitions of scheme, we basically have one plan to defraud. There's nothing in the definition of scheme that would make it seem like every that would say it's a different scheme if you're writing fraudulent checks versus using the debit card from the WCO fraudulently. It's basically all towards the same method or the same goal, which is to access monies of the WCO that you are not entitled to or that you are unauthorized to access. So that's our position in terms of scheme.
Thank you.
If I may go back. We agree that the defendant is alleged to have combined a variety of methods to complete the scheme, but the scheme to defraud remains a single scheme to defraud, a continuing course of conduct using a variety of methods with a singular intent, the intent to defraud the WCO. The WCO eventually came to know about all of the alleged methods used in the scheme, including the writing of the bad checks, the fraudulent ATM withdrawals, and the unauthorized debit card purchases by Ms. Pottola. We know this because the WCO filed a civil suit alleging the same acts of fraudulent behavior as those included and charged in the criminal felony information filed in the criminal case. The civil complaint was filed on July 25th, 2013, after the expiration of the criminal statute of limitations. The criminal felony information was filed on March 17, 2015. The Office of the Attorney General only became involved after the filing of the civil suit by the WCO and after the start of an investigation by the Department of Human Services in 2013. The aggrieved party, the WCO, had the power to investigate and purchase both criminal and civil, had the power to investigate and pursue both criminal and civil investigations and causes of action prior to the expiration of the 3-year statute of limitations. They had 3 full years to conduct their investigation, review their accounting, do their audits, make decisions on how to pursue their claims and get legal advice, and also to follow up with the previously filed police report with the Honolulu Police Department. The statute of limitations does not stop or pause because the aggrieved party fails to complete or pursue their investigation in a timely manner. Nor does it stop or pause because they're disorganized or ineffectual or they wait for a different agency to come in and do a review. The purpose of the statute of limitations is to light a fire on the aggrieved party and the investigatory bodies to pursue and conduct their inquiries within a specific time frame. The time frame is a full 3 years, which is a generous time frame. That's more than enough time to review the books and to make decisions and to get professional opinions on what is a proper or improper transaction. But they failed to do this, and as a result, the court rightly granted the dismissal.
Counsel, does the civil lawsuit establish when WCO became aware of the facts underlying counts 4, 5, and 6 in the criminal filing?
So my answer is that the WCO became aware of irregularities in May of 2010. The civil complaint does not specify the date that they became aware of every single transaction. However, the civil complaint is telling because it does detail the same acts as alleged in the criminal complaint. So basically, it appears through the civil suit that the WCO was aware of the ATM withdrawals, was aware of bad checks written both to Ms. Patolo and to others, and was aware of improper ATM withdrawals for cash by Ms. Patolo. So prior to the expiration of the 3-year statute of limitations, the WCO had information. They just didn't share it with the Attorney General's office, who came in post-expiration of the statute of limitations. So we don't have a specific date of discovery for all those additional methods that were used, but we do know they knew about it because it was included in the civil complaint, and the amount that they allege in the civil complaint actually exceeds the amount charged in the criminal complaint. So the amount was over $700,000 in the civil charging document, but civil complaint, but in the criminal complaint, it's under $700,000. So they may have discovered even more than what the state chose to pursue in the criminal case. So that would be my answer to that. Excuse me. Ms. Patolo acted with one general intent, one scheme, one plan to defraud the WCO of monies. The series of transactions or methods she used does not mean there was more than one intent. Our position is she had one general intent to defraud using different means, therefore one scheme to defraud.
Counsel?
Yes.
Since you come back to that, did you look to see if any other states had talked about means, different means within a scheme? Or, I mean, it's hard to believe that this is super unique, but I didn't see anything supporting that.
I'm sorry, but I can't answer the question. I did not. So I apologize.
So basically, you haven't looked beyond Hawaii. So
yeah.
It's just Hawaii doesn't have something.
Correct. I did not personally do research about other states' use of the word scheme.
Fair enough.
So I'm sorry, I don't.
No,
however, the other two cases that I think are important would be the Decoit case, which basically stands for the proposition that a continuing offense is one that is motivated by a single uninterrupted criminal impulse. If there is but one intention, one general impulse, and one plan, there is but one offense.
Okay, but now, isn't the same intention, impulse, and plan when you write checks to dad as opposed to, you know, go help yourself to money out of an ATM? I mean, can't the state at least allege that that's a different intent?
So, our answer is that for this particular offense, we have a 3-year period of time, 2007 to 2010, 3-year period of time, where she's allegedly doing these financial irregularities. And in the course of it, we have different methods. Our argument is that you have to look at the whole picture for this particular case, and that it's not about one day and one check. That would be like trying to parse out one single thing from an entire scheme. And we would say that they can choose to charge it that way, but the way the law seems to be, or at least Stans, contracting Ducoit, and also the Castro case seem to be focusing on what was the general intent, what was the plan. And so our argument is that if she wrote a check to her dad, that's still a plan to take the monies from the WCO and defraud the WCO. So that would be my answer to that.
But we already looked at Stans, and Stans didn't really address the method versus the scheme.
That is correct. Yeah, that's still kind of a little bit open.
Okay, thank you.
The other case would be the Castro case, which has a test. And the test to determine whether a defendant intended to commit more than one offense in the course of a criminal episode is whether the evidence discloses one general intent or discloses separate and distinct intents. And it is our position that if there is but one intention, one general impulse, and one plan, there's just but one offense. The scheme or plan in this case was defrauding the WCO of monies. The methods or specific acts included the acts of writing unauthorized checks to herself and others, unauthorized debit and debit card cash transactions, and unauthorized debit card purchases. All acts were committed in the furtherance of the singular scheme to defraud the WCO of monies. That is basically the heart of our argument. The history of this case and how it played out is the classic example of what a statute of limitations was designed to cure. So we disagree that it is absurd. The statute of limitations was designed to give you enough time to do your investigation, to do your inquiries, but to set a limit to avoid things like stale claims, neglected claims, loss of witnesses, loss of documentation, especially in a financial fraud situation, documentation is important. Destruction of documents like receipts and ledgers, imperfect recollection by witnesses that stalled over time. So what would be absurd from our position is to fail to acknowledge that during those 3 years that they could have done so much more, but they chose not to. What would be absurd is giving them more time when there's really no excuse for them needing more than the 3 years which is statutory available to them. In this case, fraudulent transactions were immediately discovered shortly after Ms. Pitolo left her employment. So she, once she had left her job, she had no further control or access to the ledgers. Now, she did apparently have access to additional checks, and there may have been additional checks that were used after she left her employment, but all methods and acts as part of the case and as part of the scheme terminated prior to August of 2010 when the police report was made. So we do stick with our initial date of discovery of May 27, 2010. The WCO began their investigation at that time. They had 3 years to pursue their claims, and they failed to do so. And the trial court correctly ruled that the statute of limitations had expired prior to the filing of the felony information in this case. So that's all I have for this morning, unless you have any further questions.
Thank you
very much.
Thank you.
I'd like to address Stans Contracting and its statement that the statute begins when the scheme is discovered. I asked the court, and I think it's appropriate that you limit that statement or that finding to the factual context of Stans Contracting, because if you look at Stans Contracting, the false invoice transactions all terminated in 1997, and at the time of charging, everything was discovered in 2000. Here, in May of 2010, WCO or the state would not have the opportunity to know what the full extent of the scheme would be. And that's where the absurdity comes in, because then WCO or the state would not have the opportunity to discover those. Again, I'll go back to the plain language of 7101A3A, where you look at the discovery of the offense. not the scheme. So that's the state's position. Thank you.
All right, thank you. We'll take it under advisement.